know many of you listen to this podcast on the go, driving to work, working out, even doing chores. Now you can get CPE credit for that time. With Earmark, you can earn free NASBA-approved CPE for listening to the Inside Public Accounting podcast. After you listen to an episode, take a quiz, and your certificate will be ready. Earmark has courses for everyone in your firm, from staff to partners. Get started today at earmark.app or download the free app on the App Store. Numbers keep the accounting profession running, but it's the people that are behind the numbers who drive that real growth. And what separates good firms from great ones isn't just technical expertise, it's the soft skills, the communication, leadership, adaptability, and emotional intelligence. I'm Chelsea Summers, Executive Director of Inside Public Accounting and host of the Inside Public Accounting podcast. Today, we're diving into why soft skills are becoming the new bottom line in public accounting. Joining me is Amanda Garner, President of the Growth Partnership. Amanda has spent her career helping firms really sharpen their leadership, strengthen their culture, and prepare that next generation of leaders. She's a coach, a facilitator, and a trusted advisor to firms all across the country. Amanda and I are going to explore why soft skills are often undervalued and how leadership development links directly to profitability and what firms risk when they neglect this type of training. Most importantly, we'll talk about how developing people isn't just an HR initiative, it's really a growth strategy. Amanda?
Thank you so much for having me, Chelsea. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, let's start off with, so why are soft skills often undervalued in the accounting profession? And how is that really changing today?
I think that the reality that we're facing in the profession is that we have always looked at technical skills as paramount to what, you know, I actually hate the word soft skills because soft skills sounds less than. When we say soft, it's like, oh, hard is important. Soft is weak, right? That I think there's a connotation there that I hate, but it is one that is well accepted, right? I think we could change that to critical skills. These are the things that leaders have to have, that they have to bring to the table in order to elevate themselves beyond practitioners to leaders in the profession. But I think that the reality has long been that we worry first, this is the paramount concern, we worry first about technical skills, the ante to play the game. Once we've identified that somebody has the technical skills, then we're willing to consider whether they can or should be a leader. But that doesn't necessarily mean that firms have been invested in making the critical skills that are related to HR and leadership and project management, et cetera, of focus or something they're even willing to invest in. Technical skills have always come first.
So, like, in what ways are communication and emotional intelligence and really adaptability, how do they make CPAs more effective beyond that, just technical expertise?
In today's universe, we think about accounting like it is no longer just about compliance, right? There has to be an advisory component. And I think what the struggle is, if we just focus on technical skills, we're still putting compliance as the center of the universe. Compliance obviously is a piece of the puzzle. However, if we want to get people to focus on an advisory mindset, on looking out the windshield as opposed to the rearview mirror, then we have to show them that emotional intelligence matters. I brought a couple of statistics that I thought were worth sharing with you, if you don't mind. I'm going to put
absolutely
them up on the screen. But I think what's interesting to me is that 70% of employers know that soft skills are critical. You know, I like to think Daniel Goleman, really the author, the mind behind emotional intelligence, said that, you know, when you take a technical skill like accounting or like engineering, there is a baseline intelligence that comes with becoming part of that profession. What elevates a career above the baseline is emotional intelligence. And you can see here, 58% of job performance can be tied to emotional intelligence. So we know as employers that soft skills, or what I would refer to as critical skills, matter. And we know that job performance is better when emotional intelligence exists. That still doesn't mean that we've bridged the gap on being willing to make the investment and in building out those skills.
It's so interesting. We've been talking a lot on this podcast about that shift from compliance to advisory services. And I love that parallel of Compliance services require technical expertise, but advisory services really require a different skill set for the employees and how important that new skill set will be in that new accounting firm. Mm-hmm. So how do those, what did you call them, critical skills, influence client relationships and retention in a CPA firm?
I think this is really where you're going to see firms start to address the investment part. I'm going to be more willing to address the investment when I recognize a few things. First, investment in the critical skills training has a high ROI. Harvard Business School tells us about 250% ROI on soft skills training.
Oh my gosh.
That's a lot, right? So that the gap that we are looking to change to move from compliance to consulting, we have to be able to provide skills to these folks. They've got the technical skills. How do we provide them with the tool set, the arsenal that they need to become leaders in the profession? The other thing I have on the screen here is that we know that a strong leadership pipeline. So, you know, we know we've been fighting this in the profession for a number of years, that middle range, the manager level is hard to find. But a strong leadership pipeline actually equates, Deloitte tells us, to a 37% higher revenue per employee. So this data is astounding. If we don't focus our investments on the critical skills that help our leaders to grow and develop into leaders in the profession, then we are going to miss on ROI. Also, the stat that you asked me about, how does this impact firms and retention? Turnover costs, we know about 150 to 200% of salary are incurred when we have high turnover. But leadership actually improves engagement at firms by as much as 70%. Leadership training improves engagement at firms. So this is something I think at the end of the day, if firms do not invest in this, the loss of return on investment is what they're going to be facing. Because retention and recruiting are amplified when we can show that we have a good investment in our people becoming leaders in the profession.
Well, and if you tell any leader, well, I've got this thing that you can work on that's going to drive 37% higher revenue per employee, and they're going to say, sign me up. What is it? And then you say soft skills training, and they're like, oh,
right.
Like they're missing how really impactful that could be. Those numbers are incredible.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
So I want to move a little bit into leadership development and career pathing. So in the IPA survey, we see that 74% of firms have a training program for their emerging leaders, and 49% have a training program for current partners. What is what does an effective leadership development program look like inside of a CPA firm?
One thing that I like to focus firms on, Chelsea, is that it's not, I think firms have long had this mindset of flip a switch. So they become managers and we've worked on them technical. Now they become a manager. And now we say, okay, cool, you're there. If you want to be a partner, now we have to see your soft skills develop. And it's like a switch flips, right? Like we're just going to tell you now, do this. And if they've spent their whole career, probably 10 to 15 years already, not having to focus on soft skills. But now suddenly we're telling them in order for them to achieve the pinnacle of their career, they've got to have those soft skills embedded. I think that firms need to consider actually embedding this earlier, not later. And what I mean to say by that is when we build out a firm university for firms, we usually have some initial soft skill building at the staff level, at even that initial incoming young professional phase. We want them to be thinking about what it looks to be an ideal team player, as Patrick Lencioni would say. Or we want them to be thinking about how they build good habits in terms of their time management, in terms of how they're using their technology tools. We want to have them think about customer service. We want to bake that stuff in early in their careers so that later when we say, okay, now this is what you need to do to become a partner, they say, I've already got a lot of tools in my kit to do that. What else do I need at this point? If that makes sense.
Yeah, we're building on those foundational skills. And in a lot of firms, that foundation isn't there and we're building a tower on top of nothing. And in those firms where they have a strong foundation of those early skills, that makes sense that is a lot more successful for them. mentoring. In the IPA Human Resources Survey, about 71% of firms have a formal mentoring program. So what role does mentorship and coaching play in preparing that next generation of firm leaders?
I think once again, that's a super critical element, but one that often is misguided with firms. A lot of times I think there is a real challenge with mentorship programs. We put them in with good intention, but there's not a lot of real efficacy and training involved in them. In other words, I'm assigned to be a mentor. Am I good at it? Have I had any training to be a mentor? Do I know what it would look like to have a mentorship conversation? What is coaching? How do I answer the questions of somebody coming at me with a problem that they're facing? How do I help them to have the tools to come up with the solution, not to give them a solution? And so this is a challenge I think we have as well, is that when we set up these mentorship programs, we will have good intentions and we'll say, here's your mentees, meet with them quarterly. But there's not a lot given to the mentors in terms of training to be a mentee. We'll say, here's the people that you're responsible for coaching. There's not a lot of training in terms of what coaching actually looks like. And then the other piece that I think really breaks this down pretty substantially in a lot of firms that I've seen is that we set the goal, meet quarterly, but then we will put that onus on the staff person and say, you know, let me know when you want to meet. And for them, they don't know what to meet about and what to talk about. They don't know. And so it becomes this situation of discomfort rather than comfort. Mm-hmm. And then I feel like when the onus is on them, because it's uncomfortable, sometimes they won't schedule. And then you'll see the mentors say, well, I only did about a quarter of my mentorship appointments because the employee didn't ask. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, becomes kind of a reverse return on investment, where staff will see mentorship as a negative, not necessarily a positive. And one other side note here, sorry to talk so much, but one other side note that I see as a difficulty is that oftentimes firms will say, okay, every partner or every manager has to be a mentor. And you'll find that some people are good mentors and some people aren't. And then in addition, we're not giving them a lot of training. So this kind of leaves people not necessarily knowing if they have a mentor that's really going to serve them well. And then some firms will say, okay, we're only going to use the good mentors, the people, well, the ones that people want. You can select your mentor. And that is also a problem, because you'll have one partner that's a mentor to 25 people, and then others who get to escape being a mentor. So there's so many, it's fraught with a lot of issues when we think about mentorship. Do I think it's important? Absolutely. But I think we have to have good system set up and then good competency training for those who are going to execute on it in order for it to be most effective.
So talk a little bit, if you're, there's an accounting firm listening and they're like, we have a mentorship or coaching program in our firm, but it's checking all the boxes that you're saying an unsuccessful program is. How do we move from that unsuccessful program into doing something that is valuable for both the mentors and the mentees? What are the steps they can take to improve their program?
Well, I think one thing they can do is reach out to team members and ask them about the experience of the mentorship program. I think getting a good insight from your team members about whether they find it valuable, what they find valuable, what they find not so great, can give you some steerage in terms of creating a better system. If I were developing a system for scratch, I would certainly tell firms, hey, quarterly mentorship is a good idea, but I think your mentors need good tools to be able to use, which means sitting down with your mentors and giving them some critical coaching about what mentorship really looks like. And when I say what mentorship really looks like, let me give you an example of that so we understand. A mentorship conversation should be more of a career discussion as opposed to a review. A review assesses performance, right? A mentorship discussion should be, you know, what are you finding difficult in your career development right now? What are the challenges that you're facing that you'd like to be able to tackle in the next quarter? How do you see yourself progressing in your career? What do you most want to achieve? Where do you find balance? How do you see, and I could go on and on, right? But the idea is not to say, okay, here's some job performance things we want to modify. The idea of mentorship should be, how do I help them digest their career development? Does that resonate.
Yeah. And I could see why, as a staff member, if the responsibility is on you to set up those quarterly calls, and there's a fear that we are just going to be having quarterly reviews now, like that doesn't sound like something that's appealing. I would put that on the back burner also.
Yes,
but when they're forward looking and really helping you path your future, those are positive calls that the staff member would hopefully want to be on, or at least the staff members that you see progressing in their careers would want those conversations and welcome those conversations. So I think you're right, positioning those to the staff that this is the goal of these, and then making sure those mentors are really fulfilling that and asking those forward looking questions would be successful.
Yeah. And for me, that's what it's all about. How do we make sure that we are employing the team that is mentoring with the right mindset about what mentorship looks like? It should be something that they look forward to, because they're able to say, you know, I really want to move up to manager. How can I continue to hone my skills? What are some things that you think I could do? Or here's a challenge that I'm facing. You know, I really am struggling with work-life balance right now. What have you done to sustain work-life balance in your role as you've developed as a professional? So this gives them the opportunity to level set their growth.
Yeah, that makes sense. So as firms are looking at their different staff members and saying, who is our star performers? Who do we want to promote? How should a firm balance promoting those strong technical performers and also ensuring that those people are ready to lead others or to be a leader in the firm?
I think that what's really a struggle is identifying the technical skills that they have to have and having them fill those gaps, but doing that in conjunction with their critical skills development, their leadership skills development. Maybe that's project management, maybe it's time management, maybe it's customer management, but are they coming together at the same time? And to me, that means that when we are assessing and promoting, we are making sure that those skills are part of that review process, or part of that. They're part of everything that we flow through, whether it's in mentorship or in coaching, or in the review process, the employee performance review. And it should be part of the career ladder as well. These are the critical skills that you have to develop in order to succeed and reach that next level. So I think it has to be part of the whole career pathing experience, Chelsea.
Yeah, that makes sense. So earlier you pulled a couple statistics on how these critical skills affect the bottom line, but I really want to dig into that a little bit more. On average, firms are spending about 0.9% of their revenue on training in the firm. And that's according to IPA's 2025 Practice Management Survey. So how can firms measure their ROI of those critical or soft skills in their leadership development programs?
That's a great question. I think a few things can happen in relationship to this. We can just look at on a revenue spectrum, but there are a lot of things that good leadership training can compel. It can compel more productivity. So, you know, when you're talking about utilization or realization, it can compel those things. It can also compel less turnover. So there's so many different places that you could metrically assess whether or not your leadership development is effective. I think a good benchmark for spending for firms should be somewhere between $400 to $1,000 per student for annual education that is critical skills. That's a good benchmark. Now, again, that's probably higher than what you're seeing in the IPA spend. My curiosity would be, if you broke that down by the top performers versus your mediocre performers versus your lower performers, would the spend be higher at the better performers?
I have a sneaking suspicion that you would be correct on that, for sure.
And that's where I think the reassessment of this has to live. If we want to retain the best people, we have to be able to fuel their career. If we want to have the best performance, we have to be able to teach what that best performance would look like.
Right.
And some of that is reducing runoff at firms. How do we retain clients? Some of it is helping them to build the skills that are going to amplify their presence in the community. And some of it is helping them build the skills that are going to help them make connections that make sales. I have a great story for you, and I have to share it kind of illustration-wise, I think, here. I worked with a firm for about 15 years out in the Northwest, and I was talking with one of their leading partners, one of their senior partners, and he said, you know, we're just really struggling because we cannot get accountability at the partner level for business development and marketing. And I'm like,
common story.
Yeah, common story. And I'm like, that sounds familiar. Tell me why you think that is. Well, I think, you know, some of them feel like their books are full, et cetera, et cetera. I said, okay, understood. He's like, but you would think these new partners would come in hungry. And so I continue to ask questions. By the way, that's the best coaching behavior, is ask questions. So I said, you know, help me understand these new partners. Do they have a good example of what it would be like to be focused on business development and community involvement? Well, no, because all of the senior partners, they've grown their books enough already, so they're not really involved in that anymore. Okay, so we've taken away the example, but then here was the real kicker. I said to him, well, who do you think the next partner will be? And he said a name, and I said, interesting. I wouldn't have suspected that because I was coaching a good number of their managers at the time. I said, why that person? And he said, you know, at the end of the day, his technical skills are so good. And I said, interesting. I was thinking it would be this other person, person B. And he said, yeah, her technical skills just aren't there. And I said, but she developed $150,000 of new business last year. How much new business did partner or did manager A develop? Zero. And I said, so you're not only telling them by mentorship, by example, that business development and community involvement is not important. You're telling them then by reward, because you're rewarding the technical skills first,
right,
over the person who may not be as technically savvy, but is savvy when it comes to advisory and customer development. So, you know, I tell this story because I think it's important to acknowledge that we often are, you know, you used to say we are what we eat. And if what we choose compels certain behaviors, then we have to make different choices to compel different behaviors.
Yeah. I think that's a good example too, that you can have all the training and right processes in place, but if there's not good examples, they're not going to get followed. And the end of it, and there's not good incentives, like you said, the right people are getting promoted by doing the things that you really do want to reward, then you're just in a hamster wheel of, you know, things that are not working out as you would like them to. So I think that is a very powerful story, and I appreciate you sharing that. So we talked about positive costs, but I want to talk about some hidden costs. So things like burnout or turnover or disengagement when firms aren't doing this kind of training.
You know, I'm going to tell you another story here because I think I live through story myself. But I have one of the most epically fabulous managing partners that I have had the privilege of working with for a whole bunch of years. But one of the things I've had to coach her on multiple occasions is that, you know, she consistently has a ridiculously high hours at the end of the year. And she'll speak about it. You know, she'll talk about her hours as though they are a badge of honor. And I've talked to her at length about how sometimes I think, again, it comes back to what example are you setting? And does that example align with where people want to see themselves? I think, you know, in a lot of ways, she does align with where people want to see themselves. But I think in some ways, if she's working 3,500 hours a year, then she might be saying to people, you can't ever be me. It would be too hard. Mm-hmm. And so I do think that it's important to really consider what we're putting out there for people in terms of how they will see themselves. And back to your real question, how does this impact burnout? I think any good critical skill development program, whether you call it a firm university or just whether you're investing in critical skill training every year for your team, that's not technical, non-technical training. I think it has to involve some level of awareness about balance. And I think if you're not doing that today, you're a little bit tone deaf. I'm not suggesting that people shouldn't work hard. Of course they should. I am suggesting that if we are tone deaf to what people are saying, that they struggle with an 80-hour work week, that we are going to continue to lose the traction we're gaining. And I mean, there was great news in accounting today, just a couple of months ago, that we're seeing matriculation rates in the accounting profession rise again for the first time in a long time. So God bless the work of the people who are getting in there and helping people to sign up and bringing accounting back to the forefront in terms of professions. But this is functionally, we have to understand that our profession has to continue to evolve if we do not want to see people say, I don't want to be this. I don't want to do this. I can find something that will fit my skill sets elsewhere that will feed my family and also allow me to have some balance. And I don't mean to paint this bleak picture of the accounting profession, because obviously it's a profession I've dedicated my own life to and that I love very much. But I do think that there is strong indication that we have to continue to shift as a profession in order to attract and retain the best people.
Right. It's great that we've got all these new individuals joining the accounting profession, but if we collectively can't do the job to keep them there, then all everybody's hard work and the high schools and the universities and all the work the AICPA is doing is just going to waste because we're letting these individuals leave. We're painting a picture in the early years that is not what they're seeing when they get to an accounting firm into their careers.
Right. That's right. I gotta share one other thing that I think makes a difference as well.
Yeah.
I think firms are really reticent to share the future with people. And maybe this is too controversial to say, but I think it is a reality that we have to confront as well. There is a fear factor about disclosing, and I understand that fear factor, but about disclosing what we make at the partner level. Net income per partner is like, that's a secret and I get it. But if you've got a manager and they are looking at a partner and saying, man, that's a lot of hours, but they cannot possibly understand what the upside of being an owner in an accounting practice looks like, then we've hamstrung ourselves a little bit. Because at that manager level, that's when we don't want them to depart. That's when we've put all the investment into building up both their technical skills and their critical skills. And we want to retain them, but we don't pull back the curtain enough for them to say, I can see the light at the end of the tunnel. I can see where my career is pathing to and why that destination is really the Emerald City. And I want to get there, as opposed to saying, just hang tight and see what happens. And then we see them leave for industry, or we see them leave and do something else completely, or maybe even start their own practice or go to another firm that has pulled back the curtain a little bit. And so I often will say to firms, I got another story for you. Like I said, full of them, can't help myself. I was with our Partner Institute program where we do leadership development on a 3-year track for burgeoning partners and managers at accounting practices. And we're in our 20th year.
Oh my gosh.
Which is so cool. I love seeing graduates who have risen to managing partner in their many years ago. One of our students was signing up to be the managing partner in a year or two. So she went through the program as a partner, gearing herself up to be a managing partner. And she said to me, you know, one of the biggest regrets that I have as I joined the partnership was I really didn't get to look at the partnership agreement and know what was in store for me until just a few days before I was signing it and having to do my buy-in. Yeah, that's an astonishing thought, right? And I said, that's crazy. And she said, I will never allow that to happen to people in the future at our firm. And I thought, well, that's great, because you're seeing, you know, this changing tide. She's had a paradigm shift, so that will change the experience of becoming a partner at the firm. Fast forward about 8 years later, and they've got another, that same firm has another student in the Partner Institute. And I was coaching her and I said, you know, what's happening? She said, I'm going to become a partner. And I said, cool, that's fantastic. She said, but I'm really frustrated because I still haven't seen anything. And I am going to be signing up to be a partner and I have to make my contribution in just a few weeks. And I thought, how do you repeat the behavior again? But of course, as we become partner, I think it's easy to lose sight of what you thought you were going to change, because perhaps you see the beauty in the system as it is and you don't feel like it's necessary to make that change anymore. So I guess my challenge is to firms, how do you make that process a little longer of a runway so that you help create more retention in that moment?
Absolutely. And we were just talking about that, I think, on the last episode of the podcast about transparency and increasing transparency in the accounting profession and how that really benefits everybody and is something that firms should strive towards, because it's certainly not happening now. So that echoes everything that's near and dear to my heart as well.
Yeah, for sure, Chelsea.
So
The accounting profession is going through some massive changes right now. And everything from AI to you can't have a conversation without mentioning private equity and what those private equity investments in the accounting firms is changing, not only for those accounting firms, but the profession as a whole. How do these soft skills help, or these critical skills help these firms and these leaders in the firms navigate these disruptions that are coming or really are already here?
Yeah, right. I think, again, you bring up such a great question, because I think this is, we've actually changed our curriculum a lot in the last couple of years to address some of this. We've got a lot on change management. If leaders are not capable of managing change in the future, they've got a big hurdle to get over. Mm-hmm. I mean, change is just so rampant. It's every day. It's whether or not we're merging in another practice, or whether or not we are dealing with changing staff, or whether we're dealing with changing technology, or whether we're dealing with changing regulation. Change is every minute of every day right now. Mm-hmm. And because of that, they have to be able, people are afraid of change. It terrifies them. 80% of people, when a change is imposed, feel like the change is going to make things worse, not better.
Change and yet, requires work.
We got change every day, right? We can't live in that space. So leaders have to be able to lead change. That is, I think, important in any leadership curriculum right now. Another thing that I think is important is addressing learning agility. And that's, you know, new vernacular that we've put into our training programs recently. But this idea of growth mindset, of learning agility, is critical right now as well, because we have to be able to say, okay, the ball has moved a little bit today from where it was yesterday. So how are we going to get ourselves in front of the ball again? Uh-huh. And so I think learning agility is a big piece of any learning development program right now, whether that's, you know, dealing at the staff level, because they've got a lot of learning agility they have to be able to manage, or at the partner level, because there's learning agility there every day too. Sometimes I think some retiring partners are like, thank God, I don't have to learn anything else right now. So, you know, I think that is a piece of it. It's really gathering up your resilience when it comes to dealing with change and the constantness of learning today.
We've covered a lot of topics today. I would like you to leave the listeners with some advice for those that are hesitant on investing in those critical skills training, or hesitant on investing in coaching and mentorship. What would you tell them?
Wow, that is a profound question. What's the one takeaway I would want to leave them with? I think that I would say that think about possibly getting an outside resource involved to help you. One thing we know is accountants, they are great at accounting. But what we're talking about with leadership development is really about setting a course, a path that helps your people to develop the skills that you need them to have to be able to lead in the profession into the future. Uh-huh. And so I think getting somebody involved from outside your firm, or bringing somebody in-house that has a significant learning and development background, can help you to build, whether it's a mentorship program or a coaching program or a learning and development program, something that compels your firm to hire, to raise the bar a little bit higher. And so to me, I think it is recognizing that we don't have that necessarily that talent in-house. Are we going to bring it in from out of house? Are we going to bring it in-house? How do we make sure that we have put a good amount of focus on learning and development for our firm's success in the future?
Amanda, this has been so fun. You're a wealth of knowledge on all things training and learning and the changes in the accounting profession. Tell our listeners, if they want to get a hold of you or ask more questions, how can they get in touch with you?
They can reach me at agarner@thegrowthpartnership.com. They can also reach out via our website, thegrowthpartnership.com. And if they're interested in learning a little bit more about our Partner Institute program, which is really an exceptional curriculum to help people build their, how they show up as a human, how they show up as a leader of individuals, and how they show up as a leader in their practice. That program launches a new class every year. And as I said, we're in our 25th year. They can learn more about that by going to www.thepartnerinstitute.com. And then they can also reach me at 717-385-3000. 8712. I always look forward to having a good dialogue about the profession and particularly about learning and development. It is something I am so crazy passionate about. Can I share one story in close, Chelsea?
Absolutely. Let's hear it.
I think one of the things that excites me about learning and development the most is getting accountants outside of their box. And one of my favorite things that we try to implement when we are building out curriculum is experiential learning. And by that, I mean, we just don't put people in a classroom or in a virtual classroom and say, here's the content, let's digest it. We don't even just do, here's the content, let's be interactive. We also get them out of the classroom. And just to give you some examples, sometimes we'll have them do improv. Sometimes we're taking them to build a boat in the middle of the ocean, because I think there's no better way to challenge people's leadership skills than having them do something that challenging, right?
Holy cow.
Or another favorite of mine is we'll take them to, when we're teaching project management, we take them to a site where they can see project management outside of the accounting space. So traditionally, we go visit the USS Midway with our project management class. And I love this because it's profound. It's managing a city at sea of, you know, 18 to 30 year old men who are landing aircraft at hundreds of miles an hour in a space the size of a tennis court. And after that particular session, we always have the students come back and give a presentation on their experience. And one of my favorite moments recently, a gentleman from a top 100 firm who's in our partner training program, did his presentation on his experience at the USS Midway, and he had tears in his eyes. This got me. And he said, I don't think I've ever been as humbled as our trip yesterday. I had a new perspective because I feel frustrated training people beneath me, but I think about what it would be like that if I were on that ship and I'm training people beneath me, and if I don't train them properly, it's life or death. And I don't think that I have really absorbed how important it is to train them to replace me. I think I have been lazy about it. And when I see it outside of my current perspective, I think it really changes my insight into how I want to show up as a leader and how I want to show up as a trainer. And I left that thinking, this is why it is so important that we are constantly cognitive of the learning experience being not just technical, about it being something where they are able to absorb the critical skills that are going to make them transform all of the people that they are training up. Because one person's critical skills, they filter down. This is a, you know, if you really think about it, it's a waterfall effect.
Absolutely.
So if we can get at the top and at every level, those skills amplified, then we're going to find that our profession continues to evolve in a really, really profound way.
And that lesson that individual took back to their firm is going to probably resonate with them for many, many years, and hopefully something that they keep with them, and how important the job that they're doing is, and putting it in context of all the other things they could be doing and how those lessons translate.
And that lesson will translate, like I said, waterfall effect down to the people that he leads, who will then lead in a similar fashion. So I like to think, you know, it's a ripple effect. We drop a water in a pond, and what ripples are created when we are investing in leadership training? It is a ripple effect.
Yeah. I love that. What a great way to leave that. To our listeners today, if you enjoyed today's episode, share it with a colleague, leave us a quick review, and hit follow so you never miss an episode. It really helps us get these conversations in the hands of firm leaders across the profession. We've got a great lineup still to come this fall on the Inside Public Accounting podcast. We're doing some interviews covering AI, specialization and pricing strategies, succession planning, and a whole lot more. We'll also be diving into our other IPA reports and taking a closer look at the 2025 Best of the Best firms. So stay tuned. You won't want to miss what's ahead.
Thanks, Chelsea.